Chapter 87. That the movement of a heavenly body is not the cause of our choosing by virtue of its soul moving us, as some say. We must observe, however, that Avicenna also holds that the movements of the heavenly bodies are the causes of our choice, not merely by being the occasion thereof, but even as a per se cause, for he holds the heavenly bodies to be animated, since the heaven's movement proceeds from its soul, and is the movement of a body. It follows that just as for as much as it is a body's movement, it must have the power to transform bodies, so, for as much as it comes from a soul, it must have the power to make impressions on our soul, wherefore the heavenly movement is the cause of our acts of will and choice. The position of Albumisar would seem to come to the same as expounded in the first book of his Introductorium. But this position is unreasonable, because any effect that is caused by an agent through an instrument must be proportionate to the instrument as well as to the agent, for we do not employ any instrument for any effect. Consequently, it is not possible to produce by means of an instrument an effect which is utterly outside the scope of its action. Now it is altogether beyond the scope of a body's action to impress the intellect or will, as proved above, except perhaps indirectly by making an impression on the body, as we have said. Therefore it is impossible for a heavenly body's soul, if it have one, to make an impression on the intellect and will by means of the movement of that heavenly body. Moreover, the particular active cause, while acting, bears a resemblance to the universal active cause, and imitates it. Now if a human soul were to make an impression on another human soul through an action of the body, as when it reveals its mind by means of vocal signs, the bodily action that proceeds from the one soul does not reach the other soul except by means of the body, for the vocal sounds play on the organ of hearing, and thus being perceived by the sense, its meaning reaches the understanding. Consequently, if the celestial soul makes an impression on our soul by means of a corporeal movement, its action will not reach our soul except through a change effected in our body. But this does not cause our choice, but only occasions it, as we have shown above. Therefore the heavenly movement is not the cause but only the occasion of our choice. Again, since mover and moved must be simultaneous, as is proved in 7 Physics 2, it follows that movement must come from the first mover to the last thing moved in a certain order, so that, to wit, the mover moves that which is distant through that which is nearest. Now our body is nearer to the heavenly body which is supposed to be moved by the soul united to it, than our soul which is not ordered to the heavenly body except through its own body. This is proved by the fact that separate intellects are not ordered to a heavenly body, except perhaps as a mover to that which it moves. Therefore the impression of a heavenly body that originates in its soul does not reach our soul save through our body. And our soul is not moved in response to the movement of the body except accidentally, nor does choice result from an impression made on the body except as occasioned thereby, as we have said. Therefore the heavenly body's movement cannot be the cause of our choice through coming from its soul. Besides, according to the opinion of Avicenna and certain other philosophers, the active intellect is a separate substance which acts on our souls in so far as it makes what is potentially intelligible to be understood actually. Now this is the result of abstraction from all material conditions, as is clear from what we have said in the second book. Consequently, that which acts directly on the soul does so not by means of a corporeal movement, but rather by abstraction of everything corporeal. Therefore the soul of heaven, if it have a soul, cannot be through the heavenly movement the cause of our acts of choosing or understanding. By the same arguments it can be proved that the heavenly movement is not the cause of our choice by the power of a separate substance. If anyone suppose the heaven not to be animate, but to be moved by a separate substance. Chapter 88. That created substances cannot be the direct causes of our acts of choosing and willing, but God alone. We must not think, however, that the souls of heavenly bodies, if there be any, or any intellectual separate substances, can directly impel our will or cause our choice. For the actions of all creatures are subordinate to divine providence, so that they are unable to act beside its laws. Now it is a law of providence that everything is moved immediately by its proximate cause. Consequently, unless this order be observed, the higher created cause can neither move nor act. Again, the proximate moving cause of the will is the good understood, which is its object, and it is moved thereby as sight by color. Therefore no created substance can move the will except by means of the good understood in so far, to wit, as it shows it that a particular thing is good to do, and this is to persuade. Therefore no created substance can act on the will, or cause our choice, except by way of persuasion. Again, a thing is naturally moved by and passive to that agent by whose form it can be reduced to act, since every agent acts by its form. Now the will is made actual by the appetible object, which stills the movement of its desire, and the will's desire is satisfied by the divine good alone as its last end, as we have proved above. God alone can move the will as an agent. Besides, the natural inclination, which we call the natural appetite, of inanimate things for their proper end is like the will or intellectual appetite in intellectual substances. Now a natural inclination cannot be given except by the maker of nature. Therefore the will cannot be inclined to anything except by the cause of the intellectual nature. But this belongs to God alone, as we have proved above. Therefore he alone can incline our will to anything. Moreover, as stated in 3 Ethic, I, a violent action is one in which the principle is external, and the one who suffers violence contributes nothing. Consequently if the will be moved by an external principle, its movement will be violent, and I speak of being moved by an external principle that moves as an agent, and not as an end. Now the violent is opposed to the voluntary. Therefore it is impossible that the will be moved by an external principle as an agent, and every movement of the will must come from within. But no created substance is united to the intellectual soul in its inmost being except God alone, who alone is the cause and sustainer of its being. Therefore the movement of the will can be caused by none but God alone. Further, violent movement is contrary to natural and voluntary movement, because both of these must be from an internal principle. But an external agent does not cause a natural movement except in so far as it causes an internal principle of movement to be in the movable thing. Thus the generator that gives the form of gravity to the generated heavy body gives it a natural downward movement. And nothing else external can move a natural body without violence, except perhaps indirectly, as that which removes an obstacle, for such a thing makes use of natural movement or action rather than causes it. Therefore that agent alone can cause a movement of the will without violence, which causes the internal principle of that movement, namely the power itself of the will. And this is God, who alone creates the soul, as we proved in the second book. Therefore God alone can move the will, as an agent, without violence. This is expressed in the words of Proverbs 21, 1. The heart, O, the king is in the hand of the Lord, whithersoever he will he shall turn it. And Philip 2, 13. It is God who worketh in us, 41, both to will and to accomplish, according to his good will. Chapter 89. That the movement of the will, and not only the power of the will, is caused by God. Some, nevertheless, unable to understand how God can cause in us the movement of the will without prejudice to liberty, have endeavored to give a false exposition to the authorities quoted. They say, in fact, that God causes in us to will and to accomplish, by causing in us the power to will, and not by causing us to will this or that. This is the exposition of Origen, who defended free will in a sense contrary to the aforesaid authorities. Apparently this was the source of the opinion of some who maintain that providence does not regard things subject to free will, namely our elections, but only external happenings. For he who chooses to get or do something, for instance to build or get rich, is not always able to succeed, and so the outcome of our actions is not subject to our free will, but is ordained by providence. But the authority of Scripture is in manifest opposition to all this, for it is said, O Lord, thou hast wrought all our works in, 48, us. Hence we receive from God not only the power to will, but also our very operations. Further, the very words of Solomon, "Whithersoever he will, he shall turn it," show that the divine casualty extends not only to the will, but also to its act. Again, not only does God give things their powers, but also nothing can act by its own power, unless it act by his power, as we proved above. Therefore man cannot use the will power given to him, except for as much as he acts by God's power. Now the thing by whose power the agent acts, is the cause not only of the power but also of the act. This is apparent in the craftsman, by whose power the instrument acts, even though it may not have received its form from the craftsman in question, and is merely applied by him to action. Therefore God is the cause not only of our will but also of our willing. Further, order in spiritual things is more perfect than in corporeal things. Now in corporeal things every movement is caused by the first movement. Therefore in spiritual things every movement of the will must be caused by the first will, which is God's. Besides, we proved above, that God is the cause of every action, and that he works in every agent. Therefore he is the cause of the movements of the will. Again, Aristotle argues in the same sense, as follows. There must be some cause of a person understanding, taking counsel, choosing and willing, because everything new must have a cause. And if the cause of these acts was another act of counsel and another act of will, since in such things we cannot proceed to infinity, we must come at length to something first, and this first thing must be something better than the reason. And nothing but God is better than the intellect and the reason. Therefore God is the first principle of our counsels and wills. Chapter 90. That human choice and will are subject to divine providence. Hence it follows that human will and choice are subject to divine providence. For whatsoever God does, he does according to the order of his providence. Wherefore, since he is the cause of our choice and will, are subject to divine providence. Moreover, all corporeal things are governed by means of spiritual things, as we have shown above. Now spiritual things act on corporeal things by their will. Consequently, if the acts of choice and will in intellectual substances are not the concern of God's providence, it follows that corporeal things also are withdrawn from his providence, so that there will be no providence at all. Besides, the higher a thing is placed in the universe, the more must it participate in the order in which the good of the universe consists. Hence Aristotle reproaches the ancient philosophers for admitting chance and luck in the scheme of the heavenly bodies, but not in the things of the lower world. Now intellectual substances hold a higher place than corporeal substances. Therefore if corporeal substances, as regards their essence and operation, are included in the order of providence, much more so are intellectual substances. Again, those things which are nearest to the end are more subject to the order whereby things are directed to the end, since by their means even other things are ordered to the end. Now the actions of intellectual substances are more intimately ordered to God in their end than the actions of other things, as we have proved above. The actions of intellectual substances come under the order of providence, whereby God directs all things to himself, more than the actions of other things. Further, the government of providence proceeds from God's love for the things created by him, for love consists chiefly in this, that the lover desires the good of the beloved. Consequently, the more God loves a thing, the more it comes under his providence. This is the teaching of Holy Writ, Psalms, Xliv, 20, where it is said, "The Lord keepeth all them that love him," and the philosopher also says that God cares most for those who love the intellect, as being his friends, from which we may conclude that he loves intellectual substances most of all. Therefore their acts of will and choice are the object of his providence. Moreover, man's interior goods, which depend on his will and action, are more proper to man than external goods, such as acquiring wealth, and the like. Wherefore a man is set to be good in respect of the former and not of the latter. Consequently, if human choice and the movements of man's will do not come under divine providence, but only external happenings, it will be truer to say that human affairs are not the concern of providence than that they are. But the former saying is put into the mouth of blasphemers: "He doth not consider our things," and he walketh about the poles of heaven, and the Lord hath forsaken the earth, and the Lord seeth not, and who is he that hath commanded a thing to be done, when the Lord commandeth it not?" Some passages in the Holy Doctrine might seem to give utterance to that opinion. Thus it is said God made man from the beginning and left him in the hand of his own counsel, and further on he hath set water and fire before thee, stretch forth thy hand to which thou wilt. Before man is life and death, good and evil, that which he shall choose shall be given him. Also consider that I have set before thee this day life and good, and on the other hand death and evil. But these words indicate that man has a free will, not that his choice is withdrawn from divine providence. Likewise, the statement of Gregory of Nyssa in his book on man regards those things that are not in our power, and not those that are, and the saying of Damascene, who followed him, in the second book, that God knows but does not predetermine the things which are in our power, are to be understood as meaning that the things which are in our power are not subject to the divine predetermination in such a way as to be necessitated thereby. Chapter 91. How human affairs may be referred to higher causes. From what has been proved, we are able to gather how human affairs are to be referred to higher causes, and do not happen by chance. For acts of choice and will are under the immediate governance of God. Human knowledge pertaining to the intellect is directed by God through angelic intermediaries. While things pertaining to the body, whether internal or external, and adapted to man's use, are governed by God by means of the angels and heavenly bodies. There is one general reason for this: because everything that is multiform, changeable and defectible must be referred to a principle that is uniform, unchangeable and indefectible. And everything connected with us is multiform, changeable and defectible. For it is clear that our choice is made in many different ways, since different people choose different things in different circumstances. Again, our choice is changeable both through the instability of the mind, which is not firmly fixed on the last end, and because things themselves change in the midst of which we live. That man's choice is defectible is proved by his sins. On the other hand, the divine will is uniform, since by willing one he wills all things, and is unchangeable and indefectible, as we proved in the first book. Therefore, all movements of will and choice must be traced to the divine will and not to any other cause, because God alone is the cause of our willing and choosing. In like manner, our intelligence is manifold, since from many sensible objects we gather into one, as it were, the intelligible truth. It is also changeable, since by discoursing it passes from one thing to another, from the known to the unknown. Again, it is defectible, through admixture of imagination and sense, as the errors of men testify. On the other hand, the cognition of the angels is uniform, because they receive the knowledge of truth from the one fount of verity, namely God. It is also unchangeable, because they see the truth about things, not by discoursing from effects to cause or vice versa, but by simple intuition. It is also indefectible, since they see intuitively the very natures or qualities of things in themselves, about which the intellect cannot err, as neither can the senses about their proper sensible objects, whereas we gather the nature of a thing from its accidents and effects. Therefore, our intellectual knowledge must be ruled by the knowledge of the angels. Again, as to human bodies and the external things of which men make use, it is evident that they are blended together and contrary to one another in many ways, also that they are not always moved in the same way, because their movements cannot be continual, and that they are defectible by alteration and corruption. Whereas heavenly bodies are uniform, being simple and devoid of all contrariety. Also, their movements are uniform, continual and unchangeable, nor can there be corruption or alteration in them. Consequently, our bodies and whatever else serves for our use must be ruled by the movements of the heavenly bodies. Chapter 92. How a man may be said to be fortunate, and how he is assisted by higher causes. It may be seen from what has been said how a man is said to be fortunate. For a man is said to have good luck when something good happens to him beside his intention. For instance, when a man, while digging in a field, finds a treasure which he was not seeking. Now a man, while working, may do something beside his own intention, yet not beside the intention of someone above him. For instance, if a master send a servant to a place whither he had already sent another servant without the knowledge of the former, the finding of the latter is unintentional to the former, but not to the master who sent him, and therefore although in relation to this servant the meeting is fortuitous and casual, it is not so in relation to the master, but is intentional. Since then man, as to his body, is subordinate to the heavenly bodies, as to his intellect, to the angels, and as to his will, to God, it is possible for something to happen beside the intention of man, which is nevertheless according to the order of the heavenly bodies, or the influence of the angels, or even of God. And although God's action alone has a direct bearing on man's choice, nevertheless the angel's action has a certain bearing on man's choice by way of persuasion, and the action of a heavenly body by way of disposition, insomuch as the corporeal impressions of heavenly bodies on our bodies dispose us to choose in certain ways. Accordingly when, through the influence of higher causes, in the aforesaid manner, a man is let to choose such things as turn to his profit without his being aware of the utility by his own reason, and besides this, his understanding is enlightened from the light of intellectual substances to the effect of doing those same things, and through the divine operation his will is inclined so as to choose that which is profitable to him, without knowing why it is so, he is set to be fortunate, and on the contrary he is set to be unfortunate, when through the influence of higher causes his choice is inclined to contrary things, as it is said of someone, Jeremiah 22:30, write this man barren, a man that shall not prosper in his days. Yet herein we must observe a difference, for the impressions of heavenly bodies on our bodies cause in us natural dispositions of the body. Consequently from the disposition left in our body by a heavenly body, one is said not only to be fortunate or unfortunate, but also to have a good or a bad natural disposition, in which sense the philosopher says Moral. Locke, cit, that to be fortunate is to have a good natural disposition, for it is inconceivable that the fact of one person choosing what is useful and another what is hurtful, without their knowing it, be due to these people differing in understanding, since the nature of understanding and will is the same in all, because a formal difference would cause a specific difference, and a material difference causes a difference of individuals. Consequently forasmuch as the human intellect is enlightened for the purpose of operation, or the will instigated by God, a man is not said to be well disposed by nature, but to be well guarded or well governed. Again, another difference is to be observed here, for the operation of an angel and of a heavenly body merely disposes a man to choose, whereas the operation of God gives completion to his choice. And since the disposition arising from a quality affecting the body, or from the persuasion of the intellect, does not necessitate his choice, man does not always choose what his guardian angel intends, nor that to which the heavenly body inclines him, whereas he always chooses in accord with God's operation in his will. Hence the guardianship of the angels is sometimes frustrated, according to Jeremiah 51:9, we would have cured Babylon, but she is not healed, and much more so the influence of heavenly bodies, whereas divine providence never fails. Yet another difference must be observed, for since a heavenly body does not dispose a man to choose, except for as much as it makes an impression on our bodies, so that a man is influenced in his choice, in the same way as he is led by his passions to choose, every disposition towards choosing resulting from the influence of the heavenly bodies, is by way of a passion, as when one is led to make a certain choice, through hate, love, or anger and the like. On the other hand, a man is disposed by an angel to make a certain choice, by way of intellectual consideration, without passion, and this happens in two ways. Sometimes man's understanding is enlightened by an angel so as to know only that a certain thing is good to do without being instructed as to the reason for its being good, which reason depends on the end. Consequently sometimes a man thinks it good to do a certain thing, and yet were he asked why, he would answer that he did not know. Hence when he achieves the useful end, to which he had given no thought, It will be fortuitous for him. Sometimes he is instructed by the angel who enlightens him, both as to the goodness of a thing to be done, and as to the reason why it is good, which reason depends on the end. And so, when he achieves the end to which he looked forward, it will not be fortuitous. It must also be noted that the active force of a spiritual nature surpasses that of a corporeal nature in being wider in its scope even as it is higher in its kind. Consequently, the disposition caused by a heavenly body does not extend to all those things that come under the scope of man's choice. Again, the power of the human soul or even of an angel is restricted in comparison with the divine power, which extends universally to all beings. Hence some good can happen to a man both beside his intention, and beside the influence of heavenly bodies, and beside the angelic enlightenment, but not beside divine providence which is the governor, even as it is the maker of being qua being, wherefore it must hold all things in its power. Consequently some good or evil may happen to a man by chance both in relation to himself, and in relation to heavenly bodies, and in relation to the angels, but not in relation to God. Because in relation to God not only in human affairs but in all things whatsoever, there then can be nothing fortuitous or unforeseen. And since fortuitous things are those which are unintentional and moral goods cannot be unintentional, because they are founded on choice, in their respect no man can be described as fortunate or unfortunate. Although in their respect one may say that he has by nature a good or evil disposition, when through the natural dispositions of his body he is inclined to the choice of virtue or vice. With regard to external goods, which can accrue to man beside his intention, he may be described both as having a natural disposition for them, and as having good fortune, and as governed by God, and as guarded by the angels. Man receives yet another assistance from the higher causes, with regard to the performance of his actions. For whereas man has the faculty to choose and to prosecute his choice, in either case he is sometimes helped by higher causes, and sometimes hindered. With regard to his choice, as we have said, in so far as a man is either disposed to choose a certain thing through the influence of heavenly bodies, or enlightened as it were through the guardianship of angels, or led through the operation of God, with regard to the execution, in so far as man receives from some higher cause strength and efficiency to accomplish his choice. These things may come not only from God and the angels, but even from heavenly bodies, in so far as the aforesaid efficiency may be seated in the body. For it is evident that even inanimate bodies receive certain forces and efficiencies from heavenly bodies, even besides those which result from the active and passive qualities of the elements, which qualities, without any doubt, are subject to the heavenly bodies. Thus that the magnet attracts iron is due to the power of a heavenly body, and in the same way certain stones and plants have occult powers. Wherefore there is no reason why one man should not receive through the influence of a heavenly body, a certain efficiency for certain corporeal effects, that is not possessed by another man. For instance, a physician for healing, a farmer for planting, a soldier for fighting. But this efficiency is bestowed on man by God much more perfectly for the purpose of accomplishing his works. Accordingly, as regards the first kind of assistance, which man receives in choosing, God is said to direct him, and as to the second, he is set to strengthen him. These two assistances are indicated in the Psalms, where it is said, in reference to the first, "The Lord is my light and my salvation, whom shall I fear?" And in reference to the second, "The Lord is the protector of my life, of whom shall I be afraid?" There is, however, a twofold difference between these two assistances. The first is that by the first man is assisted both in things subject to his skill, and in others, whereas the second assistance extends only to such things for which man's skill is available. Thus if a man while digging a grave, find a treasure, this does not result from any skill of his, wherefore with a view to such a result a man may be assisted through being instigated to seek where the treasure is, but not by receiving the skill for finding treasures. But that a physician heal, or that a soldier conquer in battle, may result both from assistance received in the choice of means adopted to the end, and from skill received from a higher cause for the success of their actions. Hence the first assistance is more universal. The other difference is that the second assistance is given for the purpose of accomplishing what one intends to do. Wherefore, since the fortuitous is unintentional, a man cannot properly speaking be said to be fortunate through receiving such assistance, as he can through receiving the former kind of assistance, as we have shown above. Now, a man is fortunate or unfortunate sometimes when he acts alone, as when he finds a hidden treasure while he is digging, and sometimes through the concurrent action of another cause, as when a man while going to market intent on buying, meets a debtor whom he did not expect to meet. In the first instance the man was assisted to his good fortune, solely in that he was directed in the choice of something to which a profit was accidentally attached beside his intention. In the second instance, both agents need to be directed to choose an action or movement resulting in their mutual encounter. There is yet another observation to be made about the foregoing, for it has been said that the happening of good or bad fortune to a man, both is from God, and may be from a heavenly body, inasmuch as man is led by God to choose a thing to which some advantage or disadvantage is attached without being considered by the chooser, and in so far as he is disposed by a heavenly body to make such a choice. This advantage or disadvantage, in reference to man's choice, is fortuitous; in reference to God, it is no longer fortuitous, whereas it is so in reference to the heavenly body. This is proved as follows. An event does not cease to be fortuitous until it is referred to its per se cause. Now, the power of a heavenly body is an active cause, not by way of understanding or choosing, but by way of nature, and it is proper to nature to tend to one thing. Accordingly, if a certain effect is not one thing, no natural power can be its per se cause. And when two things are united together accidentally, they are one not really, but only accidentally. Wherefore no natural cause can be the per se cause of such a conjunction. Suppose then that the man in question is led through the impression of a heavenly body, as by a passion, as we said before, to dig a grave. Now the grave and the place of the treasure are not one thing save accidentally, because they have no mutual connection. Consequently, the power of the heavenly body cannot cause an inclination per se to this effect considered as a whole, namely that the man in question should dig a grave and a place where a treasure is. Whereas one that acts through the intellect can cause an inclination to this whole, because it belongs to an intelligent being to direct many things to one. It is also plain that a man who knew the treasure to be there, might send another who knew it not, to dig a grave in the same place, so that he might find the treasure unintentionally. Accordingly, such fortuitous events, when referred to the divine casualty, cease to be fortuitous, but not when they are referred to a heavenly cause. The same argument shows that a man cannot be fortunate in every possible way through the influence of a heavenly body, but only in this or that respect. When I say in every way, I mean that a man is not by nature such that through the influence of a heavenly body, he chooses always or nearly always those particular things to which some advantage or disadvantage is accidentally connected. For nature is directed to one thing only, and the things in regard to which man is fortunate or unfortunate are not reducible to one, but are indeterminate and infinite in number, as the philosopher says, and is evident to anyone with sense. Therefore it is impossible for anyone to be of such a nature as invariably to choose those things which have some advantage incidental to them. But one may be inclined by a heavenly body to choose something to which an incidental advantage is attached, and by some other inclination, to choose something else, and by yet a third inclination, to choose yet another thing, but not by one inclination to choose them all. Whereas man can be directed to all things by the one divine disposition. Chapter 93. Is there such a thing as fate, and what is it? We may gather from the foregoing what we should think about fate. For observing that many things happen in this world accidentally, if particular causes be taken into consideration, some have maintained that such things are not subordinate to any superior causes. According to this opinion, there is no such thing as fate. Others, however, endeavor to refer such things to certain higher causes, asserting that they are directed thereby so as to proceed from them in orderly fashion. These held that there is fate, as though things which appeared to happen by chance were ifada, that is foretold or preordained by someone. Some of these pretended to ascribe all contingent occurrences of this world to the casualty of heavenly bodies, not excluding human elections, and they held that all such things are subject to the directing force of the stars, which force they called fate. This opinion is impossible and contrary to faith, as we have already shown. Others, however, wish to assign to the direction of divine providence all such things as appeared to happen by chance in this lower world. Wherefore they maintain that all these things are subject to fate, this being the name given by them to the disposition which divine providence causes to be in things. Hence Boethius says, fate is a disposition inherent to changeable things, by which providence connects each one with its proper order. In this definition, disposition stands for order. The words inherent to things are included to differentiate fate from providence, because the order as existing in the divine mind and not yet impressed on things is providence, but as already expressed in things, is called fate. Changeable is added to show that the order of providence does not deprive things of contingency and changeableness, as some maintained. In this sense, to deny fate is to deny divine providence. Since, however, we should not use even names in common with unbelievers, lest use of the same expressions lead us into error, the faithful should not use the word fate, lest they seem to agree with those who, having false notions about fate, subject all things to the force of the stars. Hence Augustine says, if anyone gives the name of fate to God's will or power, let him keep his opinion, but hold his tongue. And Gregory in the same sense says, far be it from the minds of the faithful to think that fate is anything real.